Brother Guy in Woods does not need to be introduced to this audience. He conducted a very outstanding meeting in Henderson last fall. We're still hearing people talk about that meeting. He has been a part of the Freed Hardeman College lectureship, lo, these many, many years. He is known throughout the Brotherhood as a writer, lecturer, debater, and evangelist. He is a former student of Freed Hardeman College. He has published a number of books, Second Coming and Other Sermons, How to Use the Greek New Testament, Commentary on the Epistles of Peter, John, and Jude, the Woods-Porter Debate, Woods-Cognell Debate, the Woods-Nunry Debate. Many of you have not seen. It's a good long time ago, but it is in print. He's editorial writer for the Gospel Advocate and also for the Adult Quarterly, Bible School Quarterly. He holds a law degree and is a member of the bar in Tennessee and Texas, but he has never practiced law. He devotes his time exclusively to gospel meetings, lectures and debates, and things of that kind. He is engaged in more than 100 religious discussions. He is a friend of Freed Hardeman College. We get letters from all over the country. Young men telling us that Brother Guy Woods has highly recommended Freed Hardeman College. We appreciate the great work that he's doing. He stands for the things for which Freed Hardeman has stood through the years, or Freed Hardeman stands for the things that Guy Woods has stood for the last 40 years as a gospel preacher. We're glad to have him back here. I would like to help him by asking you, when you want to speak, stand up. He cannot recognize your hand, so many people here many times. Stand up and wait until you're recognized and then speak up, because it'll be hard for him to hear you in this auditorium. But now it is a real honor for me to have the privilege of presenting Brother Guy in Woods to conduct our open forum.
Well, thank you, Brother Bradfield, and I am delighted indeed to have this opportunity again, as I have through the years, to participate with you, and that's precisely what it amounts to in these discussions from time to time. I feel saddened, particularly in the realization that the last time that I stood in this pulpit, just a few weeks ago during the meeting that I conducted here near the end of October, as I remember, Brother Dixon led singing during one of the morning services, which I believe was the last time he directed singing, as he so capably had done through the years. And then just 10 days later, word came that he had passed away. We are saddened, of course, by his going, but happy that the mantle has fallen into the hands of Brother Claude Gardner, whom I regard most highly, and I feel that no man could have been selected who would see to it that the principles that we've taught through the years here will be continued along with the rest of this excellent faculty in this school. And so I'm happy to be here today and to see all of these many people with whom I've been associated through many years, some of you this past year in meetings, others in years long gone by. I sincerely hope that this lectureship this year may be the crowning event of all the lectureships that we've had, and that we may be able to accomplish a great amount of good. I am a little bit amused at the nature of the questions that I have thus far received. Far more of them have to do with the marriage relationship than any other questions that I've received. Now, I take it then that our listeners are more interested in that subject than in any other, if I may judge by the questions that have been presented. I am reminded in this connection of the time when Williams Jennings Bryan approached his prospective father-in-law for his daughter's hand back in a day when it was customary to ask for the daughter. Knowing that the prospective father-in-law was a religious man, Bryan felt that some scripture might impress him, and so into his speech he wove a statement or two. Among them he said that Solomon had said that he that getteth a wife getteth a good thing. But the old man, quick as a flash, came back and said, yes, but Paul said it is better to abide as he was. Well, that stumped Bryan for just a moment, but he quickly recovered by pointing out that while he was aware that Paul had said that, he was more inclined to take what Solomon said because Solomon had much more experience.
Brother
I would assume that Brian, by virtue of such an observation, would be a liberal. If a husband knowingly looks upon a woman or women to lust after her, would this adultery in his heart constitute scriptural grounds for his wife to divorce him and marry another man? I think not. I am of the opinion, strongly of the opinion, and I think it can be established, that the type of adultery, or fornication as the word is in Matthew 19:9, has reference to the overt act. Dear Brother Woods, I've held meetings where people wanted to be baptized who were living together unmarried. In some places they claim that if they stay together for 2 years, they're looked upon by the state as married. Please comment on this. Well, in the first place, to cohabit in that fashion is a violation of the state laws. One could be arrested for such an arrangement, even though their motives were to continue to live together the rest of their days. Certainly, such would not be acceptable to God under the present arrangement. Now, it is a fact that in some foreign lands, there are circumstances where common law marriages are accepted as legal, in which case couples who intend to live together all of their lives cohabit for that purpose. We're not speaking of that situation, nor is this queries. He's asking a question here that has to do with conditions prevalent in this country today. I would just answer it by saying no. Such is not acceptable in God's sight, and it would be wrong, first, because it would be adultery, secondly, because it would be a violation of God's law. We'll introduce several of these and give you a chance to comment. Does a brother or sister who is not under bondage in such cases as in 1 Corinthians 7:15 mean that they're not under bondage to live together, are not under bondage to remain married and thus free to marry again? Brother Whiteside, in his commentary on Romans, takes the position that they are free to remarry. I never did believe that. You have asked my opinion of this. I think that the context there shows that the bondage is the bondage of responsibility in the marriage state. Here, for example, is a sister married to an unbeliever. He serves an ultimatum on her. You either quit the Lord or I'm going to quit you. Well, normally she has an obligation to her husband and she has an obligation to the Lord. In this case, of course, her duty to her Lord transcends that to her husband. Let him go, in effect, is what the apostle said. You are not under bondage in such cases. That is, not under bondage to perform the duties of the marriage relationship. In that same context, I would remind you, the apostle points out that in a case of one married to another and then they are separated, either let them remain unmarried or else be reconciled. And so, such is my view of what the passage teaches. If a Christian widow should remarry and the second companion is not a Christian, in order to repent of not marrying only in the Lord, must she stop living with the second companion? There's one thing about this forum here. The questions are not usually easy ones, as you can well see. Now, I don't hesitate to deal with this. Because in the very nature of the case, the reason why it's raised is for information, and I'm not about to avoid it. I don't think that she would have to stop living with the second companion. Now, you might say, well, she's entered into a relationship that she was forbidden to do. I think that's right. I think she was or is forbidden to marry except in the Lord, by which I think the passage means a Christian. I have no doubt but what that's what it means. But now watch. Her sin was in entering upon that relationship, not maintaining it, assuming now that there were no barriers to her remarrying, assuming that she had a right to remarry. Now, I'd like to make very clear that I'm speaking only of a sister who didn't know that she was violating God's law, later found it out. I have no doubt but that the Lord would not be pleased with a person who deliberately entered upon a relationship of that type, expecting to make some sort of a acknowledgement or confession thereafter. I am not including that type of situation. I think in a case of a Christian widow who didn't know that she was violating God's law and later found it out, ought to make an acknowledgement that she had done wrong in marrying. But in view of the fact that there are no barriers to that relationship, I see no reason why she couldn't maintain that relationship. Now, it may well be that you will see it entirely in a different light. In which case, we're going now to give you an opportunity to say so. Who will be our first speaker on any of these matters? Now, don't necessarily limit it to any one of them. It would be strange if on so many different subjects that I have expressed fully your views about it. All right, does anybody have anything they want to say on this particular subject? If not, we'll take up some more of them here. Is it scriptural to move a piano or organ into the church building for a wedding or a funeral? Now, insofar as the scripturalness of it is concerned, I know of no reason why you couldn't move an organ into this building, as much so as you could move it into a dormitory over there, or move it into a store building downtown. There would be no sin in the mere moving of the instrument into the building. That's what this question asks here. Is it scriptural to move a piano? I've always taken people at their face value. This is evidently what the querist meant to ask. If it's not, what did he ask? Let me, of course, go on to say that in the first place, though, by moving one into a church building, in most instances, you jeopardize the title to the property. You actually do. Now, many brethren do not realize that, but most congregations today have a restrictive clause in the deed. That clause reads, in effect, that in the event an instrument of music should be moved into the church building, that the congregation nearest the location of the building that's remaining faithful to the Lord will automatically come into possession of the property of the building and of the grounds thereof. Now, that's the situation in many instances, and most brethren are not aware that they actually jeopardize their title to the property. I know of an instance out in Oklahoma some years ago where a brother, and he was a cantankerous one, there's no question about it, he was always crossways with the brethren. And particularly, did he oppose the elders on everything they raised. Well, they moved an instrument into the building, and he went down to the courthouse and dug out an old deed that was recorded there and found out that this clause was in the deed. Well, he got him a lawyer, and he and the lawyer were about to take over the property. The brethren had withdrawn from him because of his cantankerousness, but they got busy and rescinded the order right quickly because they didn't want to lose title to the property. Well, he, of course, was using this as a club over their heads. They got busy, and by a legal maneuver, they eliminated that clause from the deed by buying another piece of property close by. I personally have this feeling about such matters. I don't think it violates any scriptural principle to use a piano or organ in a wedding. But we do not use mechanical instruments of music in our worship. Such is not characteristic of the places where we worship. Now, if somebody wants to have music, and I mean instrumental music, in their wedding, then why don't they go where it's used? That's my feeling exactly. I would advise, for the reasons offered, plus this additional one, that it tends to weaken our position with the denominational world. Now, we know there's a difference, but sometimes it's a little hard to explain the difference to others who do not have the background that we have. Now, have I covered this to your satisfaction? Does anybody have a comment on the piano question? Yes, sir.
I'm faced with this problem all the time. I think we ought to make it clear that we do not believe that the instrument ought to be used in a worship service. Now, that's what we believe, isn't it, brethren? That's plain and simple. But sometimes we get all torn up over this business of the instrument and sing, "I love you truly," which is nothing more than a secular love song. And surely, brethren, I do not believe that that constitutes worship. And don't anybody go running out of here and say the head of the music department's for instrumental music in the worship. He missed it, if he did that. But I'm faced with this problem sometimes. And I think we find ourselves in an inconsistency if we contend that we cannot use an instrument, a piano, an organ, in a wedding, and make that co-equal to worship. I certainly don't think we want to do that, and I recall Brother Joe Blue one time said, the reason we don't have cake and ice cream on the Lord's table is that that's been regulated, and the worship has been regulated. We want to keep that regulated, intend to see that it's kept that way.
Well, that states very clearly my view of the matter, 100%. But then that doesn't deal with the question of moving the instrument into the church building. Now, what about that, Brother Doyle?
According to the judgment of the brethren in the local community, the answer could be yes, clearly. Or, if in the case of a deed like this, the answer could be no.
All right, who else wishes to comment their own? Your brethren will have to help me see now, because there's so many people here this afternoon. All right, sir.
Are we to separate a marriage ceremony from church worship? Am I not correct in assuming whenever saints gather together that this is a worship service? Or is it not?
I believe that Brother Doyle and I are distinguishing between worship and the use of an instrument in a wedding. Yes, sir. I don't consider that a wedding involves worship. Brother Doyle and I both agree that it is wrong to worship God with an instrument anytime, any place, under any circumstances, whether it's in a church building or not.
And my second question.
Well, what I found that it's been difficult to explain to the people of the neighborhood, the bringing in of the piano into the building and using it for worship, for weddings. Now, in explaining to them that this was not a worship service, then usually the question comes back, do you people not consider marriage sacred?
Well, I consider marriage sacred, but I don't consider that it's wrong to put a piano in the home where the marriage is just as sacred at home as it is in the church building. That was my point a while ago, that it's hard to explain these matters to people. Now, for example, I was engaged some time back in a debate in California. It was with a Baptist preacher, but we were debating the question of instrumental music one night of the debate. And he said, your brethren get out here every Sunday afternoon and sing in these conventions to the accompaniment of instrumental music. Here you are up here opposing it. I said, well, that doesn't make it right. All you're doing is just proving that the brethren need to be taught more on this themselves. Now, so far as that aspect of it is concerned, I think we're all clear on it. But the only question is, in matters not involving worship, and I don't see how that there'd be any basis for opposing it just on the ground that it's a wedding.
Well, would you comment on the appropriateness of it at a funeral service?
Well, I believe that I believe in singing religious songs, scriptural songs. It's wrong to use the accompaniment of an instrument, and that would apply to a funeral or whatever circumstance it might be. All right.
Brother Wood, can you comment on the fact of using an instrument, singing spiritual songs and hymns, spiritual songs with the accompaniment of an instrument as far as entertainment or as far as just doing it so in the home? For instance, we often hear a lot of our on the radio sometimes. I've heard so-called members of the church sing these spiritual songs on the radio with the accompaniment of guitars.
Well, all I can do is to repeat what I've said over and over, that I believe it's wrong to sing religious songs to the accompaniment of an instrument anytime, any place. That'd include the radio as well as anywhere else. Jim Kelly.
Brother Woods, this is not my knowledge. This is something I gained last week from an explanation of this same subject. A man drew a lesson here from three things. He said the only way you can use the instrument of music, the only way you can use music in any way in connection with religion, is in three categories. You might sit down to learn a song by picking it out on some particular instrument. You might use it for entertainment, or you use it for worship. If you use it for worship, it's wrong any time under any circumstance. If you use it for entertainment in connection with religious music, you've taken the song and the meaning of it too lightly, so it makes it wrong in connection with entertainment. And there is a possibility, on the other hand, that you might be able to sit down with it and learn by it, but if you use it for entertainment, you've taken it too lightly. And if you use it for worship, it's wrong unto him, sir.
I agree with your 3 points. I think they're well taken. So far as picking out the music on the piano to learn the tune, that doesn't involve the worship at all. It doesn't involve even the use of sacred things. Let me ask you this. Would it make any difference to put a tune to profanity? Well, then what is profanity? Isn't it a flippant use of sacred things? A lot of brethren and sisters, too, who give utterance to certain bywords are usually not aware of the seriousness of what they're doing.
Brother Wood?
Yes, sir.
Maybe Brother Gaw could comment on this, though. How do you distinguish in psalms at a wedding? Because some, like I Love You Truly, are secular, but many that we use at least border on the religious. They mention God and the sacred. How do you going to distinguish even though you're in a place where the instrument could be used?
Well, I would simply be selective with my material. I would not pick a piece of material to use with an instrument that, of course we would get in a real ticky area here, but I would certainly be selective and try to pick songs, something like I Love You Truly, because we don't want to be placed in the position of saying that it's wrong to sing a love song with a piano. I don't think we've ever taught that or believed that for the Bible. Ever, on any occasion. Now, I know we can get caught in some very terrible circumstances. In fact, the speaker that asked me this question was caught in a terrible circumstance one time. He prayer in a service, and there was a lady there playing the organ that thought it would be a wonderful thing to have an organ with that prayer, and I was terribly embarrassed for the preacher that just asked me that question, because I knew that wasn't his position. But he was so wise in not raising a fuss right at the moment about that.
Well, of course, there are many, many other aspects of this, but we started out on the question of what is scriptural. Now we've got into the question of what constitutes a scriptural song, which is an entirely different subject from what we started with. All right, sir.
Brother Wood, I've got 2 points. One is, as they're picking that tune out, learning the song, are they going to sing the words with it? And is that sin? The second is, does the motivation or the motive have anything to do with it? I remember a statement I read from Brother Hartman one time that said something like this. A little bootblack on the street might be singing a spiritual song, but does that constitute worship? And his statement was, if it did, he didn't go to do it.
Well, that's a very interesting observation, but then... The question is before us is what is scriptural with reference to the use of an instrument in worship? And I'm aware of the fact that many times you have to know all the details, all the circumstances involved to pass a clear judgment on that. I had that